Chapter 3. Between the night I got back and the quake, I'd made many observations. About Father, for example. I loved Father, in a sort of irregular graph with many low swoops, but I began to see that his strong will didn't fill him out as a passable man. Most of what he accomplished boiled down to shrewd. He had acquired with luck and shrewdness a quarter interest in a booming circus, together with young Star. That was his life's effort. All the rest was an instinct to hang on. Of course, he talked that double talk to Wall Street about how mysterious it was to make a picture, but Father didn't know the ABCs of dubbing or even cutting, nor had he learned much about the feel of America as a bar boy in Ballyhegan, nor did he have any more than a drummer's sense of a story. On the other hand, he didn't have concealed paresis, like blank. He came to the studio before noon, and with a suspiciousness developed like a muscle, it was hard to put anything over on him. Star had been his luck, and Star was something else again. He was a marker in industry, like Edison and Lumiere and Griffith and Chaplin. He led pictures way up past the range and power of the theater, reaching a sort of golden age before the censorship. Proof of his leadership was the spying that went on around him, not just for inside information or patented process secrets, but spying on his scent for a trend in taste, his guess as to how things were going to be. Too much of his vitality was taken by the mere parrying of these attempts. It made his work secret in part, often devious, slow, and hard to describe as the plans of a general. Where the psychological factors become too tenuous, and we end by merely adding up the successes and failures. But I have determined to give you a glimpse of him functioning, which is my excuse for what follows. It is drawn partly from a paper I wrote in college on A Producer's Day, and partly from my imagination. More often I have blocked in the ordinary events myself, while the stranger ones are true. In the early morning after the flood, a man walked up to the outside balcony of the administration building. He lingered there some time, according to an eyewitness, then mounted to the iron railing and dove head first to the pavement below. Breakage, one arm. Miss Doolan, Starr's secretary, told him about it when he buzzed for her at 9. He had slept in his office without hearing the small commotion. "Pete Zavras," Starr exclaimed. "The cameraman?" "They took him to a doctor's office. It won't be in the paper."
"Hell of a thing," he said. "I knew he'd gone to pot, but I don't know why. He was all right when we used him 2 years ago. Why should he come here? How did he get in?"
"He bluffed it with his old studio pass," said Catherine Doolan. She was a dry hawk, the wife of an assistant director. "Perhaps the quake had something to do with it."
"He was the best cameraman in town," Starr said. When he had heard of the hundreds dead at Long Beach, he was still haunted by the abortive suicide at dawn. He told Catherine Doolan to trace the matter down.
The first dictograph messages blew in through the warm morning. While he shaved and had coffee, he talked and listened. Robbie had left a message. "If Mr. Starr wants me, tell him to hell with it, I'm in bed." An actor was sick, or thought so. The governor of California was bringing a party out. A supervisor had beaten up his wife for the prince and must be reduced to a writer. These three affairs were Father's job, unless the actor was under personal contract to Star. There was early snow on a location in Canada with a company already there. Star raced over the possibilities of salvage, reviewing the story of the picture. Nothing. Star called Catherine Doolan.
"I want to speak to the cop who put two women off the back lot last night. I think his name's Malone."
"Yes, Mr. Star. I've got Joe Wyman. About the trousers?"
"Hello, Joe," said Star. "Listen, two people at the sneak preview complained that Morgan's fly was open for half the picture. Of course they're exaggerating, but even if it's only 10 feet... No, we can't find the people, but I want that picture run over and over until you find that footage. Get a lot of people in the projection room. Somebody will spot it."
Tout passe. L'art robuste, seul à l'éternité.
"And there's the prince from Denmark," said Catherine Doolan. "He's very handsome." she was impelled to add pointlessly, for a tall man.
Thanks, Star said. Thank you, Catherine. I appreciate it that I am now the handsomest small man on the lot. Send the prince out in the sets and tell him we'll lunch at one.
And Mr. George Boxley, looking very angry in a British way?
I'll see him for 10 minutes.
As she went out, he asked, did Robbie phone in?
No.
Call sound, and if he's been heard from, call him and ask him this. Ask him this. Did he hear that woman's name last night? Either of those women? Or anything, so they could be traced?
Anything else?
No, but tell him it's important while he still remembers.
What were they? I mean, what kind of people? Ask him that, too. I mean, were they...
She waited, scratching his words on her pad without looking.
Oh, were they questionable? Were they theatrical?
Never mind, skip that. Just ask if he knows how they can be traced.
The policeman Malone had known nothing.
Two dames, and he had hustled them, you betcha. One of them was sore.
Which one?
One of them. They had a car, a Chevy. He thought of taking the license.
Was it, the good looker who was sore?
It was one of them.
Not which one? He had noticed nothing.
Even on the lot here, Minna was forgotten. In 3 years. So much for that, then. Star smiled at Mr. George Boxley. It was a kindly, fatherly smile Star had developed inversely when he was a young man pushed into high places. Originally, it had been a smile of respect towards his elders. Then, as his own decisions grew rapidly to displace theirs, a smile so that they should not feel it. Finally emerging as what it was, a smile of kindness, sometimes a little hurried and tired, but always there, towards anyone who had not angered him within the hour, or anyone he did not intend to insult, aggressive and outright. Mr. Boxley did not smile back. He came in with the air of being violently dragged, though no one apparently had a hand on him. He stood in front of a chair, and again it was as if two invisible attendants seized his arms and set him down forcibly into it. He sat there morosely. Even when he lit a cigarette on Star's invitation, one felt that the match was held to it by exterior forces he disdained to control. Star looked at him courteously.
Something not going well, Mr. Boxley?
The novelist looked back at him in thunderous silence.
I read your letter, said Star.
The tone of the pleasant young headmaster was gone. He spoke as to an equal, with a faint, two-edged deference.
I can't get what I write on paper, broke out Boxley. You've all been very decent, but it's a sort of conspiracy. Those two hacks you've teamed with me listen to what I say, but they spoil it. They seem to have a vocabulary of about 100 words.
Why don't you write it yourself? Asked Star.
I have. I sent you some.
But it was just talk. Back and forth, said Star mildly. Interesting talk, but nothing more. Now it was all the two ghostly attendants could do to hold Boxley in the deep chair. He struggled to get up. He uttered a single quiet bark, which had some relation to laughter, but none to amusement, and said, I don't think you people read things. The men are dueling when the conversation takes place. At the end, one of them falls into a well and has to be hauled up in a bucket.
He barked again and subsided.
Would you write that in a book of your own, Mr. Boxley?
What? Naturally not.
You'd consider it too cheap.
Movie standards are different, said Boxley, hedging.
Do you ever go to them?
No, almost never.
Isn't it because people are always dueling and falling down wells?
Yes, and wearing strained facial expressions and talking incredible and unnatural dialogue.
Skip the dialogue for a minute, said Star. Granted, your dialogue is more graceful than what these hacks can write. That's why we brought you out here. But let's imagine something that isn't either bad dialogue or jumping down a well. Has your office got a stove in it that lights with a match?
I think it has, said Boxley stiffly, but I never use it.
Suppose you're in your office. You've been fighting duels of writing all day, and you're too tired to fight or write anymore. You're sitting there staring, dull, like we all get sometimes. A pretty stenographer that you've seen before comes into the room and you watch her, idly. She doesn't see you, though you're very close to her. She takes off her gloves, opens her purse, and dumps it out on a table. Star stood up, tossing his key ring on his desk. She has 2 dimes and a nickel and a cardboard matchbox. She leaves the nickel on the desk, puts the 2 dimes back into her purse, and takes her black gloves to the stove, opens it, and puts them inside. There is 1 match in the matchbox, and she starts to light it, kneeling by the stove. You notice that there's a stiff wind blowing in the window, but just then your telephone rings. The girl picks it up, says hello, listens, and says deliberately into the phone, "I've never owned a pair of black gloves in my life." She hangs up, kneels by the stove again, and just as she lights the match, you glance around very suddenly and see that there's another man in the office watching every move the girl makes. Star paused. He picked up his keys and put them in his pocket. "Go on," said Boxley, smiling. "What happens?" "I don't know," said Star. "I was just making pictures." Boxley felt he was being put in the wrong. "It's just melodrama," he said. "Not necessarily," said Star. "In any case, nobody has moved violently, or talked cheap dialogue, or had any facial expression at all. There was only 1 bad line, and a writer like you could improve it, but you were interested." "What was the nickel for?" asked Boxley evasively. "I don't know," said Star. Suddenly he laughed. "Oh, yes. The nickel was for the movies." The 2 invisible attendants seemed to release Boxley. He relaxed, leaned back in his chair, and laughed. "What in hell do you pay me for?" he demanded. "I don't understand the damn stuff." "You will," said Star, grinning, "or you wouldn't have asked about the nickel." A dark, saucer-eyed man was waiting in the outer office as they came out. "Mr. Boxley, this is Mr. Mike Van Dyke," Star said. "What is it, Mike?"
"Nothing," Mike said. "I just came up to see if you were real."
"Why don't you go to work?" Star said. "I haven't had a laugh in the rushes for days."
"I'm afraid of a nervous breakdown."
"You ought to keep in form," Star said. "Let's see you peddle your stuff." He turned to Boxley. "Mike's a gag man. He was out here when I was in the cradle. Mike, show Mr. Boxley a double wing, clutch, kick, and scram."
"Here?"
asked Mike.
"Here." "There isn't much room."
"I wanted to ask you about..."
"There's lots of room."
"Well..."
He looked around tentatively. "You shoot the gun."
Miss Doolin's assistant, Katie, took a paper bag, blew it open.
"It was a routine," Mike said to Boxley. "Back in the Keystone days."
He turned to Star. "Does he know what a routine is?"
"It means an act," Star explained. "Georgie Jessel talks about Lincoln's Gettysburg routine."
Katie poised the neck of the blown-up bag in her mouth. Mike stood with his back to her. "Ready?" Katie asked. She brought her hands down on the side. Immediately, Mike grabbed his bottom with both hands, jumped in the air, slid his feet out on the floor one after the other, remaining in place and flapping his arms twice like a bird.
"Double wing," said Star,
and then ran out the screen door which the office boy held open for him and disappeared past the window of the balcony.
"Mr. Star," said Miss Doolin, "Mr. Hansen is on the phone from New York."
10 minutes later, he clicked his dictograph and Miss Doolin came in. There was a male Star waiting to see him in the outer office, Miss Doolin said.
"Tell him I went out by the balcony," Star advised her.
"All right. He's been in 4 times this week. He seems very anxious."
"Did he give you any hint of what he wanted? Isn't it something he can see Mr. Brady about?"
"He didn't say. You have a conference coming up. Miss Maloney and Mr. White are outside. Mr. Broaka is next door in Mr. Rindmoon's office."
"Send Mr. Rodriguez in," said Star. "Tell him I can see him only for a minute."
When the handsome actor came in, Star remained standing.
"What is it that can't wait?" he asked pleasantly.
The actor waited carefully till Miss Doolin had gone out.
"Monroe, I'm through," he said. "I had to see you."
"Through?" said Star. "Have you seen Variety? Your pictures held over at Roxy's and did 37,000 in Chicago last week."
"That's the worst of it. That's the tragedy. I get everything I want, and now it means nothing."
"Well, go on, explain."
"There's nothing between Esther and me anymore. There never can be again."
"A row?"
"Oh, no, worse. I can't bear to mention it. My head's in a daze. I wander around like a madman. I go through my part as if I was asleep."
"I haven't noticed it," said Star. "You were great in your rushes yesterday."
"Was I? That just shows you nobody ever guesses.
Are you trying to tell me that you and Esther are separating?
I suppose it'll come to that. Yes, inevitably it will.
What was it? Demanded Starr impatiently. Did she come in without knocking?
Oh, there's nobody else. It's just me. I'm through.
Starr got it suddenly. How do you know?
It's been true for 6 weeks.
It's your imagination, said Starr. Have you been to a doctor? The actor nodded.
I've tried everything. I even, one day in desperation, I went down to Claris. But it was hopeless. I'm washed up.
Starr had an impish temptation to tell him to go to Brady about it. Brady handled all matters of public relations. Or was this private relations? He turned away for a moment, got his face in control, turned back.
I've been to Pat Brady, said the star, as if guessing the thought. He gave me a lot of phony advice, and I tried it all, but nothing doing. Esther and I sit opposite each other at dinner, and I'm ashamed to look at her. She's been a good sport about it, but I'm ashamed. I'm ashamed all day long. I think Rainy Day grossed $25,000 in Des Moines and broke all records in St. Louis and did $27,000 in Kansas City. My fan mail's way up, and there I am, afraid to go home at night, afraid to go to bed.
Starr began to be faintly oppressed. When the actor first came in, Starr had intended to invite him to a cocktail party, but now it scarcely seemed appropriate. What would he want with a cocktail party with this hanging over him? In his mind's eye, he saw him wandering, haunted, from guest to guest with a cocktail in his hand, and his grosses up $27,000.
So I came to you, Monroe. I never saw a situation where you didn't know a way out. I said to myself, even if he advises me to kill myself, I'll ask Monroe.
The buzzer sounded on Starr's desk. He switched on the dictograph and heard Miss Doolin's voice.
5 minutes, Mr. Starr.
I'm sorry, said Starr. I'll need a few minutes more. 500 girls marched to my house from the high school, the actor said gloomily. When I stood behind the curtains and watched them, I couldn't go out.
You sit down, said Starr. We'll take plenty of time and talk this over. In the outer office, two members of the conference group had already waited 10 minutes, Wiley White and Jane Maloney. The latter was a dried-up little blonde of 50, about whom one could hear the 50 assorted opinions of Hollywood.
A sentimental dope.
The best writer on construction in Hollywood.
A veteran.
That old hack. The smartest woman on the lot. The cleverest plagiarist in the biz.
And, of course, in addition, she was variously described as a nymphomaniac, a virgin, a pushover, a lesbian, and a faithful wife. Without being an old maid, she was, like most self-made women, rather old maidish. She had ulcers of the stomach, and her salary was over $100,000 a year. A complicated treatise could be written on whether she was worth it, or more than that, or nothing at all. Her value lay in such ordinary assets as the bare fact that she was a woman, and adaptable, quick and trustworthy, knew the game, and was without egotism. She had been a great friend of Minna's, and over a period of years, Starr had managed to stifle what amounted to a sharp physical revulsion. She and Wiley waited in silence, occasionally addressing a remark to Miss Doolin. Every few minutes, Reinmund, the supervisor, called up from his office where he and Broacha, the director, were waiting. After 10 minutes, Starr's button went on, and Miss Doolin called Reinmund and Broacha. Simultaneously, Starr and the actor came out of Starr's office, with Starr holding the man's arm. He was so wound up now that when Wiley White asked him how he was, he opened his mouth and began to tell him then and there.
Oh, I've had an awful time, he said, but Starr interrupted sharply.
No, you haven't. Now you go along and do the role the way I said.
Thank you, Monroe.
Jane Maloney looked after him without speaking.
Somebody been catching flies on him? She asked,
a phrase for stealing scenes.
I'm sorry I kept you waiting, Starr said. Come on in.
End of Disc 1. Disc 2.
It was noon already, and the conferees were entitled to exactly an hour of Starr's time. No less, for such a conference could only be interrupted by a director who was held up in his shooting. Seldom much more, because every 8 days the company must release a production as complex and costly as Reinhardt's Miracle.
Occasionally, less often than 5 years ago, Starr would work all through the night on a single picture. But after such a spree, he felt badly for days. If he could go from problem to problem, there was a certain rebirth of vitality with each change. And like those sleepers who can wake whenever they wish, he had set his psychological clock to run 1 hour. The cast assembled included, besides the writers, Reinmund, one of the most favored of the supervisors, and John Broacca, the picture's director. Broacca, on the surface, was all engineer, large and without nerves, quietly resolute, popular. He was an ignoramus, and Starr often caught him making the same scenes over and over. One scene about a rich girl occurred in all his pictures with the same action, the same business. A bunch of large dogs entered the room and jumped around the girl. Later, the girl went to a stable and slapped a horse on the rump. The explanation was probably not Freudian. More likely that at a drab moment in youth he had looked through a fence and seen a beautiful girl with dogs and horses. As a trademark for glamour, it was stamped on his brain forever. Reinmund was a handsome young opportunist, with a fairly good education. Originally a man of some character, he was being daily forced by his anomalous position into devious ways of acting and thinking. He was a bad man now, as men go. At 30, he had none of the virtues which either Gentile Americans or Jews are taught to think admirable, but he got his pictures out in time, and by manifesting an almost homosexual fixation on Starr, seemed to have dulled Starr's usual acuteness. Starr liked him, considered him a good all-round man. Wiley White, of course, in any country, would have been recognizable as an intellectual of the second order. He was civilized and voluble, both simple and acute, half-dazed and half-saturnine. His jealousy of Starr showed only in unguarded flashes and was mingled with admiration and even affection. "The production date for this picture is 2 weeks from Saturday," said Starr. "I think basically it's all right, much improved." Reinmund and the two writers exchanged a glance of congratulation. "Except for one thing," said Starr thoughtfully. "I don't see why it should be produced at all. And I've decided to put it away." There was a moment of shocked silence, and then murmurs of protest, stricken queries. "It's not your fault," Starr said. "I thought there was something there that wasn't there, that was all." He hesitated, looking regretfully at Reinmund. "It's too bad. It was a good play. We paid $50,000 for it." "What's the matter with it, Monroe?" asked Broacca bluntly. "Well, it hardly seems worthwhile to go into it," said Starr. Reinmund and Wiley White were both thinking of the professional effect on them. Reinmund had two pictures to his account this year, but Wiley White needed a credit to start his comeback to the scene. Jane Maloney was watching Starr closely from little skull-like eyes.
"Couldn't you give us some clue?" Reinmund asked. "This is a good deal of a blow, Monroe."
"I just wouldn't put Margaret Sullivan in it," said Starr. "Or Coleman, either. I wouldn't advise them to play it."
"Specifically, Monroe," begged Wiley White, "what didn't you like? The scenes? The dialogue? The humor? Construction?"
Starr picked up the script from his desk, let it fall as if it were physically too heavy to handle.
"I don't like the people," he said. "I wouldn't like to meet them. If I knew they were going to be somewhere, I'd go somewhere else."
Reinmund smiled, but there was worry in his eyes.
"Well, that's a damning criticism," he said. "I thought the people were rather interesting."
"So did I," said Broacca. "I thought M was very sympathetic."
"Did you?"
asked Starr sharply.
"I could just barely believe she was alive. And when I came to the end, I said to myself, so what?"
"There must be something to do," Reinmund said. "Naturally, we feel bad about this. This is the structure we agreed on."
"But it's not the story," said Starr. "I've told you many times that the first thing I decide is the kind of story I want. We change in every other regard, but once that is set, we've got to work towards it with every line and movement. This is not the kind of story I want. The story we bought had shine and glow. It was a happy story. This is all full of doubt and hesitation. The hero and heroine stop loving each other over trifles. Then they start up again over trifles. After the first sequence, you don't care if she never sees him again or he her."
"That's my fault," said Wiley suddenly.
You see, Monroe, I don't think stenographers have the same dumb admiration for their bosses they had in 1929. They've been laid off. They've seen their bosses jittery. The world has moved on, that's all.
Starr looked at him impatiently, gave a short nod.
That's not under discussion, he said. The premise of this story is that the girl did have a dumb admiration for her boss, if you want to call it that, and there wasn't any evidence that he'd ever been jittery. When you make her doubt him in any way, you have a different kind of story. Or rather, you haven't anything at all. These people are extroverts, get that straight. And I want them to extrovert all over the lot. When I want to do a Eugene O'Neill play, I'll buy one.
Jane Maloney, who had never taken her eyes off Starr, knew it was going to be all right now. If he had really been going to abandon the picture, he wouldn't have gone at it like this. She had been in this game longer than any of them except Broaka, with whom she had had a 3-day affair 20 years ago. Starr turned to Reinmund.
You ought to have understood from the casting, Reiny, what kind of a picture I wanted. I started marking the lines that Corliss and McElway couldn't say and got tired of it. Remember this in the future. If I order a limousine, I want that kind of a car. And the fastest midget racer you ever saw wouldn't do. Now, he looked around, shall we go any farther? Now that I've told you I don't even like the kind of picture this is, shall we go on? We've got 2 weeks. At the end of that time, I'm going to put Corliss and McElway into this or something else. Is it worthwhile?
Well, naturally, said Reinmund, I think it is. I feel bad about this. I should have warned Wiley. I thought he had some good ideas.
Monroe's right, said Broaka bluntly. I felt this was wrong all the time, but I couldn't put my finger on it.
Wiley and Rose looked at him contemptuously and exchanged a glance.
Do you writers think you can get hot on it again? Asked Starr, not unkindly. Or shall I try somebody fresh?
I'd like another shot, said Wiley.
How about you, Jane? She nodded briefly.
What do you think of the girl? Asked Starr.
Well, naturally, I'm prejudiced in her favor.
You better forget it, said Starr warningly.
10 million Americans would put thumbs down on that girl if she walked on the screen. We've got 1 hour and 25 minutes on the screen. You show a woman being unfaithful to a man for 1/3 of that time, and you've given the impression that she's 1/3 whore.
Is that a big proportion? Asked Jane slyly, and they laughed.
It is for me, said Starr thoughtfully, even if it wasn't for the Hayes office.
If you want to paint a scarlet letter on her back, it's all right, but that's another story. Not this story. This is a future wife and mother. However, he pointed his pencil at Wiley White, this has as much passion as that Oscar on my desk.
What the hell, said Wiley. She's full of it. Why, she goes to...
She's loose enough, said Starr, but that's all. There's one scene in the play better than all this you cooked up, and you've left it out. When she's trying to make the time pass by changing her watch.
It didn't seem to fit, Wiley apologized.
Now, said Starr, I've got about 50 ideas. I'm going to call Miss Doolin. He pressed a button. And if there's anything you don't understand, speak up.
Miss Doolin slid in almost imperceptibly. Pacing the floor swiftly, Starr began.
In the first place, he wanted to tell them what kind of girl she was, what kind of a girl he approved of here. She was a perfect girl, with a few small faults, as in the play, but a perfect girl not because the public wanted her that way, but because it was the kind of girl that he, Starr, liked to see in this sort of picture. Was that clear? It was no character role. She stood for health, vitality, ambition, and love. What gave the play its importance was entirely a situation in which she found herself. She became possessed of a secret that affected a great many lives. There was a right thing and a wrong thing to do. At first it was not plain which was which, but when it was, she went right away and did it. That was the kind of story this was, thin, clean, and shining, no doubts. She has never heard the word labor troubles, he said with a sigh. She might be living in 1929. Is it plain what kind of girl I want?
It's very plain, Monroe.
Now about the things she does, said Starr. At all times, at all moments when she is on the screen in our sight, she wants to sleep with Ken Willard. Is that plain, Wiley?
Passionately plain.
Whatever she does, it is in place of sleeping with Ken Willard. If she walks down the street, she is walking to sleep with Ken Willard. If she eats her food, it is to give her strength to sleep with Ken Willard. But at no time do you give the impression that she would even consider sleeping with Ken Willard unless they were properly sanctified. I'm ashamed of having to tell you these kindergarten facts, but they have somehow leaked out of the story. He opened the script and began to go through it page by page. Miss Doolan's notes would be typed in quintuplicate and given to them, but Jane Maloney made notes of her own. Broaka put his hand up to his half-closed eyes. He could remember
when a director was something out here.
When writers were gag men or eager and ashamed young reporters full of whiskey, a director was all there was then. No supervisor, no star. He started wide awake as he heard his name. It would be nice, John, if you could put the boy on a pointed roof and let him walk around and keep the camera on him. You might get a nice feeling. Not danger, not suspense, not pointing for anything. A kid on the roof in the morning. Ruaka brought himself back into the room.
All right, he said. Just an element of danger.
Not exactly, said Starr. He doesn't start to fall off the roof. Break into the next scene with it. Through the window, suggested Jane Maloney. He could climb in his sister's window. That's a good transition, said Starr. Right into the diary scene.
Ruaka was wide awake now. I'll shoot up at him, he said. Let him go away from the camera. Just a fixed shot from quite a distance. Let him go away from the camera. Don't follow him. Pick him up in a close shot and let him go away again. No attention on him except against the whole roof and the sky.
He liked the shot. It was a director's shot that didn't come up on every page anymore. He might use a crane. It would be cheaper in the end than building the roof on the ground with a processed sky. That was one thing about Starr. The literal sky was the limit. He had worked with Jews too long to believe legends that they were small with money. In the third sequence, have him hit the priest, Starr said.
What?
Wiley cried. And have the Catholics on our neck? I've talked to Joe Breen. Priests have been hit. It doesn't reflect on them. His quiet voice ran on, stopped abruptly as Miss Doolan glanced at the clock. Is that too much to do before Monday? He asked Wiley. Wiley looked at Jane and she looked back, not even bothering to nod. He saw their weekend melting away. But he was a different man from when he entered the room. When you were paid $1,500 a week, emergency work was one thing you did not skimp, not when your picture was threatened. As a freelance writer, Wiley had failed from lack of caring, but here was Starr to care for all of them. The effect would not wear off when he left the office, nor anywhere within the walls of the lot. He felt a great purposefulness. The mixture of common sense, wise sensibility, theatrical ingenuity, and a certain half-naive conception of the common weal which Starr had just stated aloud inspired him to do his part, to get his block of stone in place, even if the effort were foredoomed, the result as dull as a pyramid. Out of the window, Jane Maloney watched the trickle streaming towards the commissary. She would have her lunch in her office and knit a few rows while it came. The man was coming at 1:15 with a French perfume, smuggled over the Mexican border. That was no sin. It was like prohibition. Ruaka watched as Reinmund fawned upon Starr. He sensed that Reinmund was on his way up. He received $750 a week for his partial authority over directors, writers, and stars who got much more. He wore a pair of cheap English shoes he had bought near the Beverly Wilshire, and Ruaka hoped they hurt his feet. But soon now he would order his shoes from Peel's and put away his little green alpine hat with a feather. Ruaka was years ahead of him. He had a fine record in the war, but he had never felt quite the same with himself since he had let Ike Franklin strike him in the face with his open hand. There was smoke in the room, and behind it, behind his great desk, Starr was withdrawing further and further in all courtesy, still giving Reinmund an ear and Miss Doolan an ear. The conference was over.
"Mr. Mark is calling from New York," said Miss Doolan.
"What do you mean?" demanded Starr. "Why, I saw him here last night."
"Well, he's on the phone. It's a New York call and Miss Jacob's voice. It's his office."
Starr laughed.
"I'm seeing him at lunch," he said. "There's no aeroplane fast enough to take him there."
Miss Doolin returned to the phone. Star lingered to hear the outcome. It's all right, said Miss Doolin presently. It was a mistake. Mr. Marcus called East this morning to tell them about the quake and the flood on the back lot, and it seems he asked them to ask you about it. It was a new secretary who didn't understand Mr. Marcus. I think she got mixed up.
I think she did, said Star grimly.
Prince Age did not understand either of them, but looking for the fabulous, he felt it was something triumphantly American. Mr. Marcus, whose quarters could be seen across the way, had called his New York office to ask Star about the flood. The prince imagined some intricate relationship without realizing that the transaction had taken place entirely within the once brilliant steel trap mind of Mr. Marcus, which was intermittently slipping.
I think she was a very new secretary, repeated Star. Any other messages?
Mr. Robinson called in, Miss Doolin said as she started for the commissary. One of the women told him her name, but he's forgotten it. He thinks it was Smith or Brown or Jones.
That's a great help.
And he remembers she says she just moved to Los Angeles.
I remember she had a silver belt, Star said, with stars cut out of it.
I'm still trying to find out more about Pete Zavras. I talked to his wife.
What did she say?
Oh, they've had an awful time. Given up their house. She's been sick.
Is the eye trouble hopeless?
She didn't seem to know anything about the state of his eyes. She didn't even know he was going blind.
That's funny.
He thought about it on the way to luncheon, but it was as confusing as the actor's trouble this morning. Troubles about people's health didn't seem within his range.
He gave no thought to his own.
In the lane beside the commissary, he stepped back as an open electric truck crammed with girls in the bright costumes of the Regency came rolling in from the back lot. The dresses were fluttering in the wind. The young painted faces looked at him curiously, and he smiled as it went by. 11 men and their guest, Prince Age, sat at lunch in the private dining room of the studio commissary. They were the money men. They were the rulers. And unless there was a guest, they ate in broken silence, sometimes asking questions about each other's wives and children, sometimes discharging a single absorption from the forefront of their consciousness. 8 out of the 10 were Jews. 5 of the 10 were foreign-born, including a Greek and an Englishman. And they had all known each other for a long time. There was a rating in the group, from old Marcus down to old Lienbaum, who had bought the most fortunate block of stock in the business and never was allowed to spend over $1 million a year producing. Old Marcus still managed to function with disquieting resilience. Some never-atrophying instinct warned him of danger, of gangings up against him. He was never so dangerous himself as when others considered him surrounded. His gray face had attained such immobility that even those who were accustomed to watch the reflex of the inner corner of his eye could no longer see it. Nature had grown a little white whisker there to conceal it. His armor was complete. As he was the oldest, Star was the youngest of the group. Not by many years at this date, though he had first sat with most of these men when he was a boy wonder of 22. Then, more than now, he had been a money man among money men. Then he had been able to figure costs in his head with a speed and accuracy that dazzled them, for they were not wizards or even experts in that regard, despite the popular conception of Jews in finance. Most of them owed their success to different and incompatible qualities, but in a group, a tradition carries along the less adept, and they were content to look at Star for the sublimated auditing and experience a sort of glow, as if they had done it themselves, like rooters at a football game. Star, as will presently be seen, had grown away from that particular gift, though it was always there. Prince Age sat between Star and Mort Fleischacker, the company lawyer, and across from Joe Popolis, the theater owner. He was hostile to Jews in a vague general way that he tried to cure himself of. As a turbulent man serving his time in the Foreign Legion, he thought the Jews were too fond of their own skins. But he was willing to concede that they might be different in America under different circumstances, and certainly found Star was much of a man in every way. For the rest, he thought most businessmen were dull dogs. For final reference, he reverted always to the blood of Bernadotte in his veins. My father, I will call him Mr. Brady, as Prince Aga did when he told me of this luncheon, was worried about a picture, and when Lienbaum went out early, he came up and took his chair opposite.
How about the South America picture idea, Monroe? He asked.
Prince Aga noticed a blink of attention towards them, as distinct as if a dozen pairs of eyelashes had made the sound of batting wings. Then silence again.
We're going ahead with it, said Starr. With that same budget? Brady asked.
Starr nodded.
It's out of proportion, said Brady. There won't be any miracle in these bad times. No Hell's Angels or Ben-Hur when you throw it away and get it back.
Probably the attack was planned, for Populus the Greek took up the matter in a sort of double.
It's not adaptable, Monroe. In as we wish adapt to this times, in as it changes. In what could be done as we run the gamut of prosperity is scarcely conceptuable now.
What do you think, Mr. Marcus? Asked Starr. All eyes followed his down the table. But as if forewarned, Mr. Marcus had already signaled his private waiter behind him that he wished to rise, and was even now in a basket-like position in the waiter's arms. He looked at them with such helplessness that it was hard to realize that in the evenings he sometimes went dancing with his young Canadian girl.
Monroe is our production genius, he said. I count upon Monroe and lean heavily upon him. I have not seen the flood myself.
There was a moment of silence as he moved from the room.
There's not a $2 million gross in the country now, said Brady. Is not, agreed Populus. Even as if so, you could grab them by the head and push them by and in, is not.
Probably not, agreed Starr. He paused as if to make sure that all were listening. I think we can count on 1.25 million from the road show, perhaps 1.5 million altogether, and 250,000 abroad. Again there was a silence, this time puzzled, a little confused. Over his shoulder, Starr asked the waiter to be connected with his office on the phone.
But your budget, said Fleischacker, your budget is $1,750,000, I understand, and your expectations only add up to that without profits.
Those aren't my expectations, said Starr. We're not sure of more than 1.5 million. The room had grown so motionless that Prince Aga could hear a gray chunk of ash fall from a cigar in midair. Fleischacker started to speak, his face fixed with amazement, but a phone had been handed over Starr's shoulder. Your office, Mr. Starr?
Oh, yes. Hello, Miss Doolin. I figured it out about Zavris. It's one of those lousy rumors. I'll bet my shirt on it.
Oh, you did? Good, good. Now, here's what to do. Send him to my oculist this afternoon, Dr. John Kennedy, and have him get a report and have it photostated. Do you understand?
He hung up, turned with a touch of passion to the table at large.
Did any of you ever hear a story that Pete Zavris was going blind?
There were a couple of nods, but most of those present were poised breathlessly on whether Starr had slipped on his figures a minute before.
It's pure bunk. He says he's never even been to an oculist, never knew why the studios turned against him, said Starr. Somebody didn't like him, or somebody talked too much, and he's been out of work for a year.
There was a conventional murmur of sympathy. Starr signed the check and made as though to get up.
Excuse me, Monroe, said Fleischacker persistently, while Brady and Populus watched. I'm fairly new here, and perhaps I fail to comprehend implicitly and explicitly.
He was talking fast, but the veins on his forehead bulged with pride at the big words from NYU.
Do I understand you to say you expect to gross $250,000 short of your budget?
It's a quality picture, said Starr with assumed innocence. It had dawned on them all now, but they still felt there was a trick in it. Starr really thought it would make money.
No one in his senses. For 2 years, we played safe, said Starr. It's time we made a picture that'll lose some money. Write it off as goodwill. This'll bring in new customers.
Some of them still thought he meant it was a flyer, and a favorable one, but he left them in no doubt.
It will lose money, he said as he stood up, his jaw just slightly out and his eyes smiling and shining. It would be a bigger miracle than Hell's Angels if it broke even. But we have a certain duty to the public, as Pat Brady has said at Academy dinners. It's a good thing for the production schedule to slip in a picture that'll lose money.
He nodded at Prince Aga.
As the latter made his bows quickly, he tried to take in with a last glance the general effect of what Starr had said, but he could tell nothing. The eyes, not so much downcast as fixed upon an indefinite distance just above the table, were all blinking quickly now, but there was not a whisper in the room. Coming out of the private dining room, they passed through a corner of the commissary proper. Prince Aga drank it in eagerly. It was gay with gypsies and with citizens and soldiers, with the sideburns and braided coats of the First Empire. From a little distance, they were men who lived and walked 100 years ago, and Aga wondered how he and the men of his time would look as extras in some future costume picture. Then he saw Abraham Lincoln, and his whole feeling suddenly changed. He had been brought up in the dawn of Scandinavian socialism, when Nikolai's biography was much read. He had been told Lincoln was a great man whom he should admire, and he hated him instead because he was forced upon him. But now, seeing him sitting here, his legs crossed, his kindly face fixed on a 40-cent dinner, including dessert, his shawl wrapped around him as if to protect himself from the erratic air cooling, now Prince Aga, who was in America at last, stared as a tourist at the mummy of Lenin in the Kremlin. This, then, was Lincoln. Starr had walked on far ahead of him, turned, waiting for him, but still Aga stared. This, then, he thought, was what they all meant to be. Lincoln suddenly raised a triangle of pie and jammed it in his mouth, and a little frightened, Prince Aga hurried to join Starr. "I hope you're getting what you want," said Starr, feeling he had neglected him. "We'll have some rushes in half an hour, and then you can go on to as many sets as you want." "I should rather stay with you," said Prince Aga. "I'll see what there is for me," said Starr. "Then we'll go on together." There was the Japanese consul on the release of a spy story which might offend the national sensibilities of Japan. There were phone calls and telegrams. There was some further information from Robbie.
"Now he remembers the name of the woman. He's sure it was Smith," said Miss Doolin. "He asked her if she wanted to come on the lot and get some dry shoes, but she said no. So she can't sue."
"That's pretty bad for a total recall. Smith, that's a great help," he thought a moment.
"Ask the phone company for a list of Smiths that have taken new phones here in the last month. Call them all."
"All right,"